My guest, Ray Suarez, is the host of the NPR interview and phone-in program Talk of the Nation. Now Ray has written a new book about the changing social and economic life of American cities called The Old Neighborhood, What We Lost in the Great Suburban Migration. The book focuses on several cities, including Chicago, Cleveland, St. Louis, Philadelphia, Brooklyn, where Ray grew up, and Washington, D.C., where he now lives with his family. We invited Ray to talk with us about the book and about his old neighborhood. I asked which of the cities he profiled had done the most to reverse or prevent its decline.
Cleveland has done a lot of hard work.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of it hasn't yet borne fruit. But I'm still pretty optimistic about Cleveland over the long haul. Over the short haul, I'm not. It's got a poverty rate approaching 50%. It's got a population loss of just about 50%. The net outflows still exceed the net inflows. But they're doing all the right things. They're working with local lenders and developers to rebuild land that's been empty since the 1968 riots. They are taking such vacant land as there is in the city and thinking of new ways to build neighborhoods that will be affordable, appealing, give a sense of place and a sense of permanence to people who are wondering whether this should be the time that they finally give up and leave Cleveland. So I saw a lot of things that really encouraged me in Cleveland. I saw a lot of things to like in Brooklyn. I write at some length about a neighborhood called East Flatbush that had once been virtually all white and is now virtually all black, and, you know, 93, 94%. And contrary to the stereotype, contrary to the storyline that we've assigned to neighborhoods that have turned from all white to all black, its per capita income has gone up, its housing purchase price has gone up, its household income has gone up, and its average years of education has gone up. So if people say, oh, well, you know, once they come in, that's it, game over, which is the rationale that led to the neighborhood becoming all black in the first place, it's nice to see a happy ending to that story. In effect, a stable, peaceful, middle class, hardworking black neighborhood.
What do you attribute the stability to?
The idea that that those new homeowners wanted all the same things that those first homeowners wanted: a clean and decent place, a place near to public transportation, with a good institutional inheritance, churches, schools, parks, and that they had a community organization. Community organizations in all these cities that I visited end up being one of the main differences. Bank on Brooklyn. Yeah, that's what they called it, Bank on Brooklyn. And they pressured local banks to give mortgages when they hadn't been giving them. They pressured local merchants to stay when their impulse was to cut and run. Even though the new people were of a similar household income, they still needed carpets. They still needed ice cream. They still needed kids' shoes. When new minority populations move in, they don't suddenly cease to need all the things that local merchants provided. But they leave because they're afraid, and they're afraid that eventually they're going to have a store and a stock that they've paid a lot of money for that nobody's going to buy. I mean, I understand why this happens. That doesn't mean it should happen. They pressured the local merchants. They said, what do we need to do to make it possible for you to stay? They upgraded the sidewalks. They upgraded the signage. They made the shopping street inviting again. And a lot of those merchants stayed.
Can you think of a city that kind of blew it in the period of the migration from city to suburbs?
I think most of these cities that I profile, I think most of the cities in the Great Lakes, the Midwest, and the Northeast blew it right after the Second World War. Something unusual had happened in American life. We had a depression that started in 1929 and lasted roughly for 10 years. Then we had a world war that lasted all the way into the middle of the next decade. And during those years, if you look at Boston and New York and Chicago, Hartford and Pittsburgh and St. Louis, there was almost no residential construction for 16 years. Families were sharing apartments that were built for one family. People postponed getting married because of the war or the Depression or both. People who were already married postponed having children, or the guy who was going to make it possible for you to get pregnant was in, you know, Guadalcanal or Anzio or someplace. So there was all this naturally pent-up demand that was bursting. It was in this container. In 1946, when hundreds of thousands of men and women demobilized from the armed forces, where do they go? They either demobilize in San Diego, a place that they had never been before, and say, I like this. I'm going to see if I can stay here. So that's one new thing that's happening. Or they run home to their sweetheart or to their mother or father and start doing the things that 25-year-olds, the 26-year-olds would have been doing had not Hitler and Mussolini and Tojo and come along. So cities totally blew it by misreading what their people needed in 1946. Then that basic misunderstanding of how they were going to have to adapt was compounded by a federal government that started to build highways like crazy, leading right out of the city, and federal loan programs that mandated that these loans could only be used for new construction. I don't think people have really taken account of just how much damage that did. Here you had this stock of existing houses that were perfectly livable, nice places. They were the pride of their owners, and they had taken good care of them. But by giving a guy and his new wife and his new kids a loan that says you can only buy a newly built house, and New York and Chicago aren't building any of them, and Philly's not building any of them, where do you go? Well, Mr. Levitt has a place that he wants you to go see out in Long Island, and that's what happened. And all these three things together just beat the hell out of the city.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Ray Suarez. He's the host of NPR's Talk of the Nation, and he has a new book called The Old Neighborhood, What We Lost in the Great Suburban Migration. Ray, let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Ray Suarez, the host of NPR's Talk of the Nation, and the author of the new book, The Old Neighborhood, What We Lost in the Great Suburban Migration. You grew up in Brooklyn.
Like you?
Yeah, like me. Describe the neighborhood you grew up in.
It was a largely middle-brow, middle-class, blue and white collar, basically Eastern European Jews who were the descendants of earlier migration flows, and Italians, many of whom had come right to Bensonhurst from Italy. So I grew up in a neighborhood where it was commonplace to hear people speaking in foreign languages on the street, comforting even in an odd way. I mean, to me, Yiddish has a music to it. I can catch certain things. I can catch certain things in conversation. I'm not Jewish. I don't speak Yiddish. But there's something that's sort of centering, contextualizing about hearing it. I just love it. And, you know, I learned a smattering of Italian as a kid, and then when I moved to Italy as an adult, suddenly it felt like I had Italian on deposit in my head from just hearing people speaking it. It was a good place to grow up. It was occasionally a difficult place to grow up, but really not that often. And it was a place where there was enough of an economic mix, enough of a social mix, enough of every kind of possible mix except racial, that you got to see different routes in the neighborhood and different routes out of the neighborhood and think of them as possible.
Did your family face any discrimination as Latinos in a neighborhood that was predominantly Jewish and Italian?
Yeah. It wasn't as bad as it could have been because we were on the early edge and people weren't, their antenna weren't as keenly tuned. I mean, it wasn't terrible. It wasn't ugly. It was more kind of annoying, and the things that we would, inside the comfort of the bunker, you know, the apartment, we would laugh about people's projected assumptions. A teacher came over to me one day and put her arm around me and stared deeply into my eyes and said, "If you want free lunch, I don't want you to feel bad. You just tell me, and I'll give you a form, and you'll bring it home, and your mother will sign it, and we'll get you free lunch." Now, okay, it's galling to have somebody assume that you need free lunch just because of who you are. But there was no, I mean, the woman did it out of decent intentions, but wasn't onto herself enough to realize that.
But she was making a certain assumption.
Oh, exactly.
Yeah. What's your old neighborhood like now?
It's amazing how much it's changed. I was talking to a friend of mine who I went to high school with recently about it, and I said, if they had come up to us when we were in the 11th grade and said, 25 years from now, this neighborhood is going to be full of people with headscarves chatting to each other in Urdu and Russians, and there's going to be business signs in Cyrillic letters, and we'll go down to the fruit market and all the guys bagging the tomatoes are going to be speaking Spanish to each other, and there's going to be Indian dentists, and I mean, we just never would have believed it in 100 years. It felt like a little isolated part of the borough that was never going to go through the things that the rest of Brooklyn did. Of course, that was an illusion too. Eventually, this was all going to come in. But it came in a way that, with a few bumps along the way. I mean, let's not forget poor Yusuf Hawkins and the fact that he was killed on the street in my neighborhood.
This is Crown Heights?
This is in Bensonhurst. I mean, this, I don't want to make it like I've forgotten that. But given the kind of stuff that happened in other neighborhoods in the city of New York and other cities in the country, it happened quietly. It happened in a way that you didn't even realize it was happening until you come back a couple of years later. And look at all these Hasidim. I mean, there always were a couple, but now there's tons. And sitting on the same car on the B train and waiting to get off at 20th Avenue are lots of Chinese people all of a sudden, too, who've just come from Lower Manhattan, where they've done their greengrocer shopping and they've got bok choy, etc., and they're chatting to each other in Chinese, and these guys are speaking Yiddish and coming from the jewelry district, and we're all getting off together at 20th Avenue. It's amazing. It's amazing. It's like the peaceable kingdom there, or the lion lying down with the lamb. It's really interesting.
Now, you have 2 kids?
Yeah.
And you choose to live in the city. What keeps you in the city?
I can't live any other way. I mean, I thrive on it. And I think there's a grace in being known. And it's a simple thing. It's an unremarkable thing. It's almost out there on the border of banal. Just being able to walk down your street and be acknowledged by the guy on the corner who knows you, you know him. I walk my kids to school in the morning. I drop them off at the front door. They say goodbye. I run accidentally into other parents, say hello, trade bits of neighborhood intelligence, walk to the corner. There's my subway station. Go underground. 15 minutes, I'm at work. There's something humanizing. There's something comforting about the simple act of being in a place where you know people and people know you.
Well, Ray Suarez, congratulations on the book, and thank you so much for talking with us.
Great to see you, Terry.
Ray Suarez is the host of NPR's Talk of the Nation. His new book is called The Old Neighborhood, What We Lost in the Great Suburban Migration.